This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. We're still waiting for a report on police response in Newtown. We'll keep waiting for some real action on campaign finance reform. And if you're tired of waiting for more news about how much money John Rowland has cost the state, you're in luck. Those are just a few of the stories we'll talk about in The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. Join us as always, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, wnpr.org/where we live. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Joining us in studio, as always, is Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hello, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Kalila Brown-Dean is here. She's Associate Professor of Political Science at Quinnipiac University. Hello once again, Kalila.
Good morning.
And Bill Curry is a columnist for Salon.com and our political analyst. Hello, Bill.
Great to be here, John.
There's a lot to cover in the news this week, so let's start at the state capitol. Governor Malloy issued his first veto of the session, and it was, well, it was reactionary to a bill that would deal with the closure of the Meriden campus of Middlesex Community College. Essentially, Malloy is saying this matter is now resolved. Colin, this is something we've been covering a little bit here. Essentially, lawmakers said, should the Board of Regents be able to just close any campus that they want? Governor Malloy now seems to be putting an exclamation point on this.
Well, yeah. I mean, it is sort of a question of which gang of idiots do you trust more or less. I think this is actually a pretty good veto. I don't think the legislature should have the power to – I mean, it's not a legislative function, right, to make sort of basic determinations about how the school system is run. That's supposed to be done by the Board of Regents. I mean, they've acted like a bunch of ninnies, you know, for years now. It's hard to make the case that they really should be entrusted with stuff. But just as a matter of the way government's set up – yeah, they actually should be the ones who are doing this.
And does this make sense to you, Bill? I mean, that now we have some resolution to this issue that has come up this time in this session in a very serious way when people in Meriden are saying, well, look, we don't want this campus closed. We're actually going to fight back against it. At least the governor is saying we know who's in charge now around this.
Yeah, I don't quite agree with Colin on this. I would just say, first of all, closings, college campus closings always end up in legislature. Doesn't matter if they pass the bill or they don't. The Torrington campus, Winston, there are fights to close or defend these campuses, have been all of my adult life and probably before. And that'll go on. And the question is simply whether you're going to tinker with the system. The second thing is I just want to say is that, one, it was a bad call closing Meriden. It was a bad call on a number of levels. And the thing that it exposed is the process itself. And it might have been better – and here I agree with Colin – it might have been better if they looked at the process by which you can make these decisions. This wasn't even the Board of Regents. This was the president of the Board of Regents working in a murky – you know, as we do everything from, you know, baseball teams to Keno. This our political process has become one long game of hide the pee. And setting up a process that ensures that there is a chance for the public to participate and for people to consider these things properly as you would in a deliberative democracy, that would be a really good idea.
So I agree that there's a difference between disagreeing with the outcome and the final decision versus clearly outlining the process and who holds the power here. And I would hope that in the future the Board of Regents realizes how controversial this decision was and that if in fact they will now have the power to make these decisions, that they will be more inclusive. I think you owe the community to know what your plan is because it will have a detrimental economic impact as well as an educational one.
Although a couple of quick points of fact. First of all, at the level of statute right now, the power is with the Board of Regents. That's what the state law says. The Board of Regents has the power to make a decision about the closure of a campus. And this process had not been allowed to continue all the way through. That's part of Malloy's veto message, right? That it was supposed to be – ultimately had to be approved by two-thirds vote of the Board of Regents and a notice under the General Assembly. So Bill's right that this process hadn't been handled correctly so far. But in order for it to go all the way through, some other things would have had to happen.
Yeah, the implementation had already begun, however.
Yeah.
And the Board of Regents hadn't acted, yeah. So it's kind of hard.
It's a terrible idea, but I'm not sure putting the legislature in control of this kind of stuff makes a lot of sense. And it's not the way the law works now.
The governor has quite clearly put the legislature in charge of balancing the budget, dealing with some of the cuts that he proposed to the state budget and saying, well, it's off my plate. Now the legislature has to deal with it. We heard last week from Republicans at the State House. They're coming up with their own budget plan. Now the Appropriations Committee run by Democrats has found a way to approve a budget that stays below the state's imposed spending cap. They use some fancy footwork to do it. Here's how Senator Beth Bayh explained what they did.
It's our interpretation on this committee and with this budget that the long-term obligations of the teacher retirement, the jurors' state retirement, employee. State employee retirement, and other post-employment benefits represent long-term indebtedness, and that that should not be counted under the cap.
Okay. Maybe we just need to do some capology here and explain exactly what we're talking about when we're talking about the state spending cap. Hey, Bill, you used to be state comptroller. Tell us what the spending cap's supposed to do.
Well, it's supposed to limit the increase in spending in state government to to an established a mechanism tied to an inflation and income growth and so forth. And the problem is that it was written by a legislature that didn't want it. Okay, it was neither the Weicker administration nor either house of the legislature, the Democratic at the time as well, wanted it, and they wanted to make it as ambiguous as they possibly could, and that's led to 20 years of fiddling. Beth Bayh is my hero; she's a wonderful state senator. I'm wondering what the legal, what the final legal verdict on this, will be. There's a degree to which, when you keep playing with this, it's like 20 years later we've discovered that these pensions, that these pension accounts don't actually count. Wow, it took 20 years to notice that this wasn't even part of the deal to begin with. How easier it would have been for everybody else, and, you know, beforehand, if that notion had been aired.
But the argument that Beth Bayh and other Democrats are making is essentially it's been fiddled with for 20 years. If at the very least we describe it in a way that makes sense so that we can spend under the cap in a way that is transparent and clear and administrations or state legislatures don't have to move things around so very much. I mean, maybe this will clarify what has been a very fuzzy
system. I do
not
object to this on the basis of public policy. And I also, by the way, I would refer people – there's a great article in the Sunday Current – or I mean, in the last couple of days in the Current by Bill Seibas talking about why it is that the public sector inflation costs go up in something called Baumol's disease. But showing that the things we do, whether it's teaching or policing or that these are all areas in which you don't get increased productivity, which by their nature it still takes the same amount of people to do it, even though it gets cheaper to make a plasma television or a cell phone. These costs are embedded in, and that we think of it always as irresponsibility, but in fact it's the nature of the beast. And so I look at the categories that that are here, and I think that they're all reasonable. I think that the problem is not just one of irresponsibility. I think it's partly the inherent nature of governmental services. I'm just questioning whether under the existing law this clarification will pass muster, and I'm not sure.
So I think we talked in the last story about process, and I definitely agree with Representative Tony Walker. It is time for the legislature to rethink this cap system.
Yes.
Democrats and Republicans have danced around this for years, at some points exceeding the cap by $700 million. So there's always this moving target about what do we move out, how do we justify it? And that to me signals the need to rethink the cap system to figure out what needs to go in, what can't, so that every year we're not pointing the fingers when both parties are complicit in doing what the law allows them to do.
Because the problem is in the Constitution. So that gets to be – it's harder to work with it there. It's a terrible idea, and it makes government less responsive to immediate problems, particularly because of the way it's designed. There's a 5-year lagged look at personal income. And so, I mean, everything that you would want government to be, A, transparent, and B, very responsive to kind of immediate conditions in its own environment, is militated against by this system. It also encourages bonded indebtedness. I mean, obviously, if you can borrow rather than spend, the spending cap tells you do that. Now, it's really terrible public policy in a lot of ways. And it also encourages transfer of state costs to municipalities. Really, the spending cap should be, if we're going to have a spending cap, it should be some kind of aggregate look at municipalities and state. Because right now, the incentive of the state is to transfer costs to municipalities so they don't show up as part of the spending cap.
Well, you know, one thing that it is, though, as fuzzy as it is a very sharp political tool to use at times. I was president up at the Capitol a few weeks back when Governor Malloy was speaking to librarians who were worried about a very small cut to the state budget that would have caused big problems to them. And his answer, as his answer has been, Colin, to many questions about this, is, look, we've got a spending cap. I can only spend so much money. And so he's able to say, here is a top level, and we just can't go beyond that. Now, notwithstanding everything Kalila said, because it's such a sharp political tool, do we ever really change it or get rid of it?
Well, no, that's There's a political reason why we never change it and get rid of it. It's not that one, though. I mean, it's also why your kid can't borrow the car tonight because of the spending cap. You know, I mean, you can use it for all kinds of explanations, and I suppose at some level that's useful, except that everybody knows, you know, what a chimera this thing is. So I don't think people are too fooled by that. No, the reason it can't be gotten rid of is because you can't politically be the governor slash legislature who got rid of the spending cap. It just doesn't sound good. Most people out there don't really know what the spending cap is. They just know that it's a spending cap, and that sounds like something they'd like to have in state government.
On principle, it ought to go as a policy. It is a constitutional amendment. You ought to honor the process. It ought to go back to the public. If they make a decision you disagree with, you have to live with it. Having said that, however, if this does pass muster, one thing I'll point out about it is that it'll be a few more years in all likelihood before they have to do this, because this is a big change. This takes a lot of money out from under, and it it categorizes it outside of the budgetary process. And if that turns out to be lawful, then it'll be a while before they have to fiddle with it again, and I guess that's good.
Well, this actually gets us to our next topic in a way. Earlier this year, Governor Malloy announced a massive transportation plan that would cost about $100 billion. His transportation finance panel met for the first time yesterday to determine how to pay for all this. $100 billion is a lot of money. It seems tough to budget out 30 years down the road. DOT Commissioner James Redeker framed it differently when he presented it to the committee yesterday.
Sometimes it helps to go backwards. Because I think about what budgets were like in transportation 30 years ago, or what the state budget was 30 years ago. And if 30 years ago you asked me, would my budget be $1.4 billion a year now? There's no way in the world that could have ever happened. But it did.
Okay, so that's Jim Redeker talking about looking at budgets long term for things like transportation, Kalilah. So, Colin was just talking about this. One of the things about a state spending cap is it doesn't allow government to react to conditions on the ground right now. Like, for instance, our bridges and roads are crumbling and we need to spend money on them, say. And so this gets at it in a sort of interesting way. The governor is trying to put together a budget right now that is going to come in under the spending cap and is going to be balanced and is going to deal with some of the obligations. But he's also proposing something that has this kind of weird flowing, who knows how much it's going to cost 30 years down the road.
So the government that we want is not the way that government is set up to be. Government is supposed to be slow. The policymaking process, the spending process is supposed to be slow and deliberate. That's how the law is set up. So when you're saying to someone, look, this is what we need to do in the immediate term, people of Connecticut don't want to hear that. Right? They want to know right now, what are you going to do so that it doesn't take me an hour and a half to get here to Hartford from New Haven? And how are you going to pay for that? So I don't think that the governor has really laid that out enough for the average person in this state to understand that. But also, if we're devoting this amount of money to transportation, from where is that money going to come and what has to go to the side in the immediate term, that becomes a part of the discussion.
I love the little political commentary that you put in there, Kalilah. I think you woke up at 5 o'clock yes. this morning to get here to our office
no
today.
No griping here.
And
no,
we
if
think
you give your personal
anything for where we live.
Yourself, yeah.
This is what I do.
And thank you very much for that, Colin.
So props to the porcupine anyway for actually setting this panel up, right? I mean, he'll be the first to tell you, and he did. I think you may even have tape of this somewhere of him saying, I could have kicked the can down the road like everybody else does, but no, I'm actually trying to figure out how to pay for this
exactly.
stuff.
Exactly.
As they go along here, I don't have a lot of answers about this, other than the one thing that I will say about this is one of those rare instances where good public policy will actually also help you pay for something. So you got to do congestion, you got to do tolls with congestion pricing. I mean, there's sort of no way out of that. Nobody likes the sound of it very much, but and that's not going to pay for, you know, all this insane amount of money, but it really is going to help you a lot. It's going to help alleviate traffic, and it's the one thing that works, right? Congestion pricing. Combined with tolls, that's the only way you can do it. So they have one really good answer, and it will lighten up the traffic and it'll pay for stuff.
Yeah, Bill.
I say a couple things. First of all, I agree very strongly with Colin on that, and I feel that I've done my part to support infrastructure in New Jersey, New York, Massachusetts, and I think those guys should pitch in and help me out a little bit. And I just want to say two things, though. One, the 30-year thing. I mean, 30 years ago, I would not have predicted the internet, but I did think we'd have flying cars. In 2009, the federal government did its first 30-year projections in the budget debate. because both sides, Democratic and Republican, both the Paul Ryan and the Obama budget, came nowhere close to dealing with the deficit of the debt in the next 20 years. So they added an extra decade and pretended that 30 years from now it was all going to be better because they didn't want to acknowledge that the plans they were proposing were completely divorced from the rhetoric each side was espousing. And so I look at these 30-year financial plans with a great deal of skepticism. And the second thing I just want to say about it is that what we need here again, I think it's a good commission in a sense. I give some of the same credit that Colin does. You want to see the plan itself, not just the financing plan. All that we have on the table right now are about necessary infrastructure repairs that don't have nothing to do with really a new state transportation plan, a strategy. I don't trust the process in this state, which has been so closed, to do that process as it ought to be. And lastly, we don't do the things we have to do to make transit work. If we're still subsidizing development, economic development programs far away from transit routes, if we don't fix property taxes, there are two ideas in transportation. One is build it and they will come, which is the busway we have now. And the other is that you have to have a real planning effort in order going on at the same time to make both worthwhile. And I'm in the second group. And I think that if we just go ahead with this plan and we don't take care of all the other aspects of land use planning in this state, it's not going to work.
I just have to say that tomorrow on our program, we actually are going to be talking about part of the process that they're putting forward, the I-84 proposal through Hartford, the so-called viaduct. There's a lot of different ways to potentially fix or remove that, change the way traffic flows through. We're going to be talking with people about the planning process that they're opening up to the public tomorrow. Before we move on in this segment, you know, more than a decade after resigning from office, as he awaits a second prison term, Governor John Rowland is still costing the state of Connecticut money. A settlement was reached with unions that sued the state because of 2,500 layoffs by Rowland in 2003. The cost to state taxpayers about these illegal layoffs, somewhere between $100 and $125 million. Bill, that's a lot of money.
It is a little sensitive for me since he what we're paying for was Rowland's political retribution to the unions that had endorsed me in the election. And that's not just a charge. That's now a matter of settled law. That's what he did, and that's what it's costing us. And I just make this point about it, apart from all the things it says about Rowland, that you win the race and then punish people, you know, gratuitously who only express their lawful opinions in the process. I just want to go back to a point I made here many times. Over half the budget deficit that Malloy inherited arose from a single deal by Mark Ryan, Rowland's budget chief, which sent over $1 billion into private insurance companies. He then landed a job with one of them. The stuff that Rowland went to jail for was over $100 million, most of it wasted. This is another $100 to $125 million. If people had any sense of the cost of what some people call soft corruption, whether – you know, some of this is actual extortion and bribery and some of it is just influence peddling. And for the way it affects us, it does not matter. When you look at these prices, if anyone did a real forensic audit of the state budget, they would find that corruption next to health care is the second biggest driver of inflation in government and one of the only two along with health care that we could really do something about if we were serious.
So I agree. Rowland seems to be the gift that keeps on giving for this state.
Only to us.
But I put it in this perspective. There are teachers in the Atlanta public school system that are facing 30 years in prison for a cheating scandal. And the idea was, let's be very tough on them to send a message how you have harmed children and families in this area. The same needs to be said for politicians who engage in corrupt activity, who punish people for political gain, and for decades will further harm the well-being of this state and some of the most vulnerable people in this state.
I mean, I want to sort of second what both of my fellow panelists just said. And I mean, Bill's right that at some point you could just teach a course in public policy called Rowland, you know, that, and it's a course in how much money it costs to have a corrupt and unchecked leader. I mean, and there are a lot of hidden costs here. I'll just try to put a tiny little smiley face on one of the many zeros after this number and say,
wow,
it's not all going to be
good.
Yeah, well, it's not all going to be cash, right? The way it's structured.
Yes.
First of all, there are all kinds of different
lottery tickets. Are we getting lottery tickets?
No. It's going to be like extra time off and stuff like that. And so there are all kinds of different participants
spread over
in this
time.
Thing. And spread over time.
Yes.
So it's not like we have to write a check for $100 million or $120 million, whatever it is. A lot of it will be sort of charged off in ways that aren't even cash. And some of it will be spread out over time. The state government doesn't have any money to give anybody.
Yeah, no, right now, the attorney David Golub and George Jepson, our attorney general, actually put together a package that does everything possible to minimize this. And I think actually credit the state employees for agreeing to this. Mm-hmm. Everybody always says in things like this that it isn't the money, and it's always partly the money. But for some of these, but for the unions here, there was a real principle involved.
And George Jepson's actually going to be talking with reporters later on about some of the details of this. We'll have more coverage later on today on WNPR. We've got to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk more about some of the news of the week in the wheelhouse. We're talking with Bill Curry and Colin McEnroe and Kalila Brown-Dean, and with you at 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. It's the Wednesday Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. We're talking today with Bill Curry, columnist for Salon.com. Kalila Brown-Dean is Associate Professor of Political Science at Quinnipiac University, and our own Colin McEnroe, who hosts the Colin McEnroe Show here on WNPR. What's in your show today, Colin?
We're going to be talking about evolution. Specifically, we're talking to a guy who teaches biology to non-science majors at the University of Kentucky and finds out that every day he basically is in an evolution fight with people.
My goodness.
And sort of the consequences as they spill out into other areas in which sort of empirical evidence is rejected, about a lot of things.
Interesting evolution conversation this afternoon at 1 o'clock on the Colin McEnroe Show. It's been more than 28 months since the Sandy Hook Elementary School shootings, and we're still awaiting for a report on the police response there. Dave Altomare had a big piece in the Hartford Courant this week. We have seen, Colin, these after-action reports coming out of the Boston Marathon bombings much more quickly, other incidents like the Virginia Tech shooting, things that have actually led to some changes in policy. Why are we still waiting for this report?
Well, that's the big question, right? Why? And we're in some ways waiting for two reports. One of them. So the state police should be doing an after-action report. And Altomare's piece was great, by the way. I mean, he really did sort of look at how this was handled in other comparable instances. In all of those instances, the report got done. It was often done by a third party, too. That's kind of important because, look, nobody expects perfection in these situations. You've got a lot of different agencies in a very panicky mode showing up on a tiny little place called Sandy Hook that a lot of them don't even know the location of. There's going to be chaos. There's going to be confusion. There's going to be mistakes made. Nobody's looking to hang anybody. But if we have this kind of CYA attitude where we don't actually ultimately get all the information, we can't make good decisions. And that's what's happening here. So, yeah, the state police have never done – they haven't done their after-action report. Probably this should be being done by a third party anyway. The Newtown police outsourced it to the State Police Chiefs Association. So four local police chiefs produced a 9-page report, which is, sort of smaller than what you need. And, the likelihood that these guys are going to really rigorously turn up the lights on what happened there is low. But I would just conclude by sort of echoing something that you said. In these other instances, places like Virginia Tech, they've really derived valuable kinds of policies from these reports. They know better how to do a shelter-in-place thing. I think it was Colorado where the cops just said, "No, we know when to go in. We know not to wait when to go." You learn things from this stuff. We're not looking to hang an albatross around anybody's neck. We want to learn what there is to learn from this.
And so it's a little sensitive for me. My sister was at Virginia Tech when the shooting happened. I remember that delay of not being able to get in touch with her. But I also know that Virginia Tech's response to that report didn't just help that university. It changed policy at universities across the nation so that now there are text alerts that go out to students. There are multiple ways of communication. I agree with Colin. This is not about pointing the finger at anyone, blaming anyone. It is about learning. It's about prevention. And it is about really affirming what was done on that day and thinking about what can be done better, if something like this happens again.
And I'll just say, as someone who teaches on a college campus every day, you and I, we've seen the changes. We've seen how things have completely changed around as far as security, the way notifications are handled. And these all come out of these terrible incidents. We learn, don't we?
We learn. We learn from each other. We learn from tragedy. And it starts a conversation about what does it mean to prepare people in a campus setting. What should teachers do in order to protect their students? the world has changed for children in school, and it is a part of that learning process that without an independent third-party report, we can only go on assumption we don't have verifiable fact.
Bill?
One, I hate to keep coming back to this, but there is this theme that runs through about half the things we talk about on this show, and that is decision-making that is going on outside of the public view. It always ends up being costly, always ends up being frustrating. I agree with Colin. There's no one to hang here. But I would also say, though, that because this isn't like Baltimore or, Ferguson or the Boston Marathon, there's not an intrinsic scandal here. There isn't a breakdown of a widely embraced public policy. There's just a search to figure out what you can do better. I mean that's the overwhelming likelihood of what we're going to find in this report. And so it makes the slowness about this even a little bit more disturbing. And the last thing is this was as great a trauma as this state has experienced in my lifetime. And part of what the public has a right to hear is information. And the other thing that the public has a right to is closure. And the longer this stays open, the longer people wait for that. And so I'm dissatisfied with this process, with its lack of openness and with how long it's taken.
Now, we do read this week, Colin, about an internal audit, a different internal audit conducted by the Hartford Police Department's shooting range. They found that the department purchased unneeded ammunition and can't account for it all. This is not just a little ammunition here. This is not just a few bullets. It's rounds and rounds and rounds of ammunition. What happened, Colin?
Well, we don't know what happened. You know, Bill just said there's no scandal in the previous discussion, and I agree with him about that. Here there probably is a scandal. It's a scandal of gross incompetence or a scandal of actual malfeasance. So, yeah, what you got is you've got the city buying about 485,000 rounds of ammunition per year when they apparently use about 180,000 rounds of ammunition per year for training and stuff like that. So that's a lot of extra ammunition. A lot of the ammunition doesn't fit the guns that they use. They use 40 caliber guns. This was so what might have been happening? Gee, let's think about this. And they don't know where any of that ammunition is. They have no system to explain where all that excess ammunition went. The possibility that it was being sold to private parties is kind of high. Either that or some kind of fake invoicing system. I mean, I don't want to accuse anybody without any, you know, proof. And what's happened is the purchasing officer has had one of those quickie retirements. But this is either incompetence, in which case the incompetence goes up the chain of command from this guy. You can't be running a police department where there's hundreds of thousands of rounds of live ammunition. This is not coffee filters or paper for the copying machines. This is live ammunition. They don't know where it is. They don't have any system of accounting for it. And so there's a lot more questions that have to be answered about this. Either they're just goofballs and they don't know what they're doing, or somebody was doing something bad here.
And one of the things that did change coming out of Sandy Hook is we talked an awful lot, Kalila, about rounds of ammunition. How many rounds of ammunition could you put in a gun? We changed laws in this state and other places about that. Here you have a city police department that has been trying for years to get illegal guns off their streets, and we've got hundreds of thousands of rounds of ammunition, and we don't know where they went?
I think it's a very damning revelation. It's very dangerous as well. Where is this ammunition? Who allowed this to happen? Who approved this? And as Colin said, if it does not match the actual weapons, then there's a bigger question. But if you think about where we are in the Northeast, when you think about all of the concerns about gun violence, these debates about safety and about ammunition, this is where the public needs to know. The public has a right to know, and someone should be held accountable beyond sort of, well, you're no longer allowed to write the checks to make purchases. This should be an independent investigation as well.
Well, and it's also – it gets back to this issue that we had surrounding Ferguson, where we had these audits of the police departments that have all this weaponry that came in from the federal government, and you didn't know that your local town had some sort of a tank that it could roll down the street.
Or a grenade launcher.
Or a grenade launcher, right. Or all sorts of hardened equipment. Mm-hmm. This, I think, Kalila, sort of falls into the same category of – just let's ask the first question. Why did they need so many bullets in the first place?
Why do you need so many bullets? Why this particular type of bullet? And why was it not delivered in a way that you would deliver any other equipment?
Yes, what she's referring to is the purchasing officer would drive. He'd accrue 3,000 miles a year driving to Greenfield to the supplier rather than having these rounds delivered in a conventional way. There are, once again, if you think about it very hard, there might be some reasons why that might be happening.
Bill, like what? No,
just, you know, I just, you know, in our lives, I mean, going back, God, to the, almost 50 years to the Knapp Commission and Serpico, we've had questions of civilian oversight of police activity. In the city of Hartford, it's been insufficient all of my adult life. And we've looked before at all the drug arrests of the street corner guys, but never going up, the high murder rates compared to even other cities in the state. And we talked earlier about transportation in cities. If you can't deal with police in schools, then you can't get people to live in these cities. There's a piece about police culture, which is they're understandably feel defensive and embattled. It's a brotherhood. It's also a clique. It's also a secret society. It's almost like the Masons. And they resist oversight. Since 9/11, and when we rightly became so grateful to first responders, there's been an atmosphere in the last 15 years where it's really almost impossible to even suggest genuine the kind of accountability that we require from every single other public agency, at least in theory. There has to be stronger civilian oversight of the Hartford Police Department or this city's never coming back.
One thing I would quickly say, I mean, first of all of the Hartford City departments, as far as I can tell, are in a state of dysfunction. I mean, the police department, the fire department has three different scandals really going on right now. The public works department has two different major scandals within the last 2 months. I actually feel like Rovella may be a better chief than we've seen in a long time. And Bill's certainly right that these problems stretch back. This is a police department that's been operating under a federal consent decree since about 1999, I think. A special master was appointed at that time, and a lot of it has to do with what we're going to be talking vis-a-vis Baltimore. I mean, Hartford's Baltimore problems stretch back to then. In fact, ironically, one of the reasons they need so much ammunition is because I believe part of that federal consent decree mandated a higher level of firearms training because of Aquan yes. Salmon and some of the other cases that fell under that federal case where they're under governance by the federal courts.
I just want to say the chief cannot do it himself.
No.
There's a larger piece of this that involves elected officials, appointed officials. That's why I said in theory, I know all those agencies are in trouble. Mm-hmm. There's no agency dysfunction that matters as much to the life and the well-being of the city as the police department. It's where it all starts.
And it's where it gets to the big story of this week. What is happening in Baltimore, Maryland this week? Police brutality, of course, has come under scrutiny over the course of the last year. When Freddie Gray suffered wounds that eventually killed him while in police custody, after his funeral, protests began. They started as nonviolent protests. They escalated after that. Here's Connecticut's Governor Dan Malloy discussing what's been happening in Baltimore.
I hope our local police are watching what's going on and understanding. I hope we're reaching out to communities. And certainly in my own little way, on economic disparity issues, we're trying to address it.
Okay, Kalila. So there's the governor addressing something that it's sort of this week, I think, in many ways, is coming home to roost all of these stories that we've been covering since Ferguson, because it's happening in a major city. I mean, it's happening in a city that has a lot more people than Ferguson, Missouri, or North Charleston, South Carolina. As you watch what's happening in Baltimore, especially in the context of what we've just been talking about local police departments, what do you see today?
So I think when I look at Baltimore, context is so important. Baltimore is not Ferguson. Baltimore is not Staten Island, New York. And I understand that everyone wants to rush to put it into this narrative. But what you have in that city is years of complaints about excessive force. Baltimore is a larger city, but has one of the most disproportionate rates of brutality of any major area in this country. The city has paid out upwards of $4 million in the last few years. The Department of Justice interviewing and investigating what has happened there. And it also is a different process because people say, well, look, you have an African-American mayor. It's a very different political structure than what you saw in Ferguson. But you also have citizens of Baltimore saying, yes, this is about Freddie Gray, but it is about a decades-long process of people feeling under attack and under siege in their own cities. When you have an 87-year-old grandmother who suffers broken bones because a police officer says, you don't belong in this neighborhood, mm-hmm. and she says, wait, this is my home. I'm on my porch. I've lived here for 40 years. People have protested nonviolently. People have voted to make a difference. They have organized to do that and finally said none of those things have made a difference. No one cared about Baltimore. You saw us as nothing more than the context for The Wire until this happened. Let's address that indifference instead of just thinking about the rioters.
But before we move on, I was just about to actually mention The Wire, in part because of what we're going to go to in the last segment. We're going to talk about a little bit about a joke that President Obama told about campaign finance reform. And, you know, he hasn't been joking certainly about Baltimore. He's been serious about it. But he has been on the record, Kalila, as saying he's a big fan of the show The Wire. Mm-hmm. He appreciates the storytelling of The Wire. This is another one of those instances where I guess I just feel like the president of the United States might just hop in a helicopter and get up there because it's only a couple hours away, and that city needs something like the president being there, not just talking about how he likes a television show that was based on the dysfunction and horrors that have been going on there for decades.
The people of Baltimore need and deserve attention that does not just come in a reactionary way of wagging one's finger and condemning what's happening. What they are saying is there was organizing in the streets of Baltimore on Saturday night in a peaceful way. Things were brewing there. And instead, less than an hour away, people were gathered in a large hotel in D.C., you know, debating which joke was funnier and whether the president went too far in those jokes. So for not only national media, but so-called leaders and representatives to ignore what was happening in Baltimore, this is something that could have been prevented. The president needs to be there.
Yeah, first of all, those two scenes sharply contrasting, as John was saying, like, this tableau of the triviality of American politics set next to the critical importance of public policy, mm-hmm. and the choices we make and the problems we live with was extraordinary. I just want to say that I want to go back to The Wire one more time, and that is – I forget which season, but when the police captain cordoned off a neighborhood, said you can sell drugs here and we won't enforce, and of course he went down. Mm-hmm. The drug policies, the crime policies, the economic policies, people treat with this kind of urban culture, with this kind of the poor will always be with us, as if these problems were forces rather than choices that we make. The neglect of those larger policies. There was a convergence here between Ferguson, Staten Island, and Baltimore, and a whole set of other problems that have just gone on in an incubator for as long as we've been alive and never ever get the attention and the creativity and the empathy that they deserve.
And you saw that happening here where the mayor of Baltimore said, I'm going to create this hamster dam for people who want to loot. So we're going to isolate this part of West Baltimore and say, look, have at it. You can destroy it if you will. We'll deal with it after the fact. Very same defined choice that was made in the TV show happening in real life and having very detrimental consequences.
Colin?
Just a couple of quick things. First of all, there's this long history of using pop culture to explain real situations. When Somalia first began to deteriorate, people said it was like Mad Max. It was sort of like the final insult. It didn't occur to them that our actual Cold War policies had caused Somalia to turn into something that looked like one of our pop culture products. You know, not to harp on The Wire, but in the first season of The Wire, there's a scene, and this was a show that was written by and developed by journalists who really researched it. There was a scene where this really kind of nothing, good for nothing, older, you know, time serving cop got knocked over by, you know, just knocked on his back during a drug sweep. And all the cops surrounded the young man who did it and kicked him. And even Kima, one of the most beloved characters on the season, the African American lesbian, tough as nails cops, kicked that suspect and was praised by her fellow officers for kicking just as hard as the guys did. So, I mean, to say you like The Wire, if you're Barack Obama, you should go back and watch The Wire because it doesn't, in fact, you know, shortchange that aspect of it. Very quickly, the one thing I would say, one of the good things that I've seen, there was an article in The Times on page one yesterday about the fact that just about every presidential candidate, Republican and Democrat, is now developing a justice reform policy, objecting to mass incarcerations, talking about racial disparities. It's now de rigueur, even if you're most of the Republican field, to say we got to change this part of our system is crazy.
We got to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about the cross-section of entertainment and policy, including the White House Correspondents' Dinner, where they're yucking it up about how much money this next campaign is going to cost. well, you know what? It's going to cost an awful lot of money. Maybe we should be angry about it. Maybe we shouldn't be telling so many jokes. Colin McEnroe is the host of The Colin McEnroe Show. He joins us along with Kalila Brown-Dean from Quinnipiac University and Bill Curry from Salon.com. It's The Wheelhouse on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, the Connecticut DOT is inviting the public to take a look at what it's calling the I-84 Hartford Project. People can stop by the Open Planning Studio in downtown Hartford to meet planners and engineers who are looking at alternatives to redesign I-84. We'll be talking about redesigning the viaduct a better way on tomorrow's show. Hope you can join us. Today, it's The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable, joined as always by Colin McEnroe. Kalila Brown-Dean from Quinnipiac University is here along with Bill Curry, who is our political analyst and who writes for Salon.com. The whole idea of reforming our campaign finance system has seemingly become a big joke. Don't believe me? Well, in his 2010 State of the Union address, with Supreme Court justices sitting in front of him, here's what President Obama said about their recent decision on Citizens United.
With all due deference to separation of powers, last week the Supreme Court reversed a century of law that I believe will open the floodgates for special interests, including foreign corporations, to spend without limit in our elections.
Okay, now here's the president and his anger translator, Luther, yucking it up on stage at the White House Correspondents' Dinner this Saturday.
Hillary will have to raise huge sums of money, too.
Oh, yeah. She gonna get that money. She gonna get all the money. Khaleesi is coming to Westeros.
Yeah, she'll be bringing those dragons as part of a campaign to raise $2.5 billion to try and win the White House. But wait, isn't this the same candidate who's campaigning on the idea that all this money in politics is bad?
We need to fix our dysfunctional political system and get unaccountable money out of it once and for all, even if that takes a constitutional amendment.
Or are we just talking about certain kinds of money in politics? You know, the kinds that Republicans raise. Here's Jennifer Palmieri. She's the communications director for Clinton's campaign, talking to our friend Brian Lehrer on WNYC yesterday. Brian starts by talking about the revelations that the Clinton Foundation, a charitable group headed by her husband Bill, took large donations from foreign governments while Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, you know, conducting foreign policy.
Is it not unaccountable money to allow foreign governments to continue to donate to these six funds, no matter how much good work they're doing in the world, when that becomes potentially a funnel for interests that want something from the United States government? Is that not unaccountable money?
No, what's unaccountable money is money that's not disclosed. So what's unaccountable money is the money that's going into super PACs, particularly on the Republican side, that we don't know where the money is coming from. And this money is disclosed, and this money is not going to fund her campaign. This money is going to fund the very good work that the Clinton Foundation does across the globe.
Okay, there's plenty to talk about in all that, but this brings us to Connecticut as well, which was touted as the state leading the way toward campaign finance reform, and it rolled out its Citizens Elections Fund after the scandals of the Roland administration. Seemed like a good idea, right? Provide public funding for campaigns, get more candidates involved. But we've not only seen the weakening of those laws over the years, but now the first jail term of this new world. The former chief of staff to then House Minority Leader Larry Caffaro pleaded guilty to a count of mail fraud. George Gallo hired a direct mail company that he got a 10% commission from. He made more than $117,000 from the deal, and he resigned in February of 2014. Colin, we're going to turn back to the big national issue in a moment in the last couple of minutes here. But as we see this Gallo thing, I mean, I guess my premise here is this is all just really a joke, right? We talk about campaign finance reform, about changing the laws, about getting money out of politics. But here's a perfect example. We changed the laws, and somebody figured out a way to make a whole lot of money out of it.
Yeah, and actually, Gallo's not the first time. Ernie Newton also, basically, his latest round of offenses involved a violation of the Citizens Elections Fund. So, yeah, I mean, this is the irony, right, that we are often cited in the national press as a state that really addressed this problem and maybe even kind of fixed it. Here, in reality, we know that, first of all, in the last election, we didn't get candidates who weren't beholden to outside interests because so much outside money was able to flow in unaccountably through third-party donations. So that's number one. And then the other problem is that it turns out the Citizens Election Fund, whenever you hand these big chunks of taxpayer money to politicians, a lot of them treated as party money. In one, I mean, like, let's have a party, not a political party money, you know, rather than and just
a thin difference.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah, they throw it around, you know, in all kinds of interesting ways. And I was saying to you yesterday, it's kind of like we keep going to Home Depot and buying a new tool to hand the chimpanzees, and they wreck it every time. And we keep going, wow, we must not have gotten the right tool. No, they're chimpanzees. That's the problem. They're going to wreck whatever you give to them.
Kalila, your thoughts?
I think we're spending so much money in these elections and the rise of dark money where we don't know the sources of this money and, you know, what those interests are. It's really a problem to me that you can have a Massachusetts Senate election where you spend $84 million and there are people in that state who are trying to figure out, do I put food on the table or do I buy the prescriptions that I need? So as we're trying to tell people you need to be more fiscally responsible in your own lives, why can't we expect the same in campaigns and elections? So I didn't think it was funny. I thought it was actually, you know, somewhat disgusting that we already know we're setting up for one of the most expensive presidential races this country's ever seen.
Bill?
Two things. First, on the Gallo deal, reminding people of the distinction between so-called hard corruption and soft corruption. Hard corruption, that you actually put money in your pocket. Soft corruption, all the multi-billion dollar enterprises, the lobbying. Often it's the soft corruption that matters the most. And the Gallo thing is a problem, and it's going to be punished. It has been punished. We're still left – just ask yourself for a second though in terms of what we've lost. Have we lost more from that situation or from the fact that despite campaign finance, public financing of elections, the amount of money raised and funneled into these super PACs was record-breaking in this last election right here in Connecticut? And we have a prohibition, by the way, against people doing business with the state giving money to these campaigns. Yet they were all giving to these super PACs. I think it's a violation of the statute in and of itself, number one. But number two, if it isn't, it simply makes a mockery. If in fact you can just put it in another account and to go back to the Clintons or any one of the Republicans – and by the way, I don't want to just dump on them because they're no better or worse. But you set up these independent PACs now that are being run by your best friends. It's like if Hillary sets up – if Hillary's friends set up a super PAC and Bill runs it. You know, just there's no real distinction here. When Hillary said $2.5 billion, she was actually setting the goal for all the PACs, the independent ones as well as her own. Where did that figure come from? And it was bad enough they brought it up the day she was announcing. The government is odious in the sight even of patriots. People are leaving the civic life of this nation. They feel the democracy has reached a tipping point. And you can't just lecture them about voting now. You really have to make a case. I'll just lastly say when I was at the Clinton White House, I was in charge of campaign finance reform for most of the 2 years I was there. I didn't learn until I left that Harold Dickies was in charge of making sure I didn't get anywhere with it. And the lack of commitment to campaign finance reform at the top of my party is a disgrace. We still have only Jody Rell to thank for the fact that there were any of these laws put on the books in this state. And so it's time for people – if Democrats think that they can – said it in an earlier column – if they think they can raise this kind of money in the day and go out and lobby for the middle class at night, it's like thinking you can smoke crack and still be a good parent. There's a fundamental conflict here and people have to get real about it.
Colin, last word?
It's going to take some leadership and somebody actually is going to have to kind of go naked on this a little bit. I mean what Hillary Clinton is saying right now is we should have a constitutional amendment so that nobody can do this. Then I could lay down my arms. But you know somebody's going to have to lay down – somebody's going to have to lead on this and say – what she's saying right now is I have to raise a lot of money because everybody else is raising a lot of money and because of Citizens United. But somebody – is going to have to really lead. And that's going to mean saying, no, I'm going to actually run my campaign differently. I mean we need all these changes, but I'm also going to run my campaign differently. And it's not – I don't see anybody in this field who's going to
just
do
a few seconds, Kalila?
Just the amount of money in politics also dictates who can afford to run for office, which means that there becomes very little difference between candidates regardless of party label because they have to have money in order to attract money.
Kalila Brown-Dean is Associate Professor of Political Science at – Quinnipiac University. Kalila, thanks as always for coming in.
Thank
I appreciate
you.
It. Thanks to Bill Curry. He's a columnist for Salon.com. He's our Democratic political analyst. Thanks, Bill.
Great to be here, John.
And thanks
you.
To Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Thank you, Colin.
Lockbox.
Our program is always produced by Tucker Ives, along with Lydia Brown, Betsy Kaplan, and Kyle Wolf. Our digital editor is Heather Brandon. Our executive producer is Katie Talarski. Thanks to our intern, Sydney Lauro. I'm John Dankosky. Thanks for joining us in the Wheelhouse here on Where We Live.